wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning to you. You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO-FM in Portland. This is Norm Diamond, your host this morning. Community stations across the country, you may know this, have closed because of the pandemic. I want to thank the resourceful staff at KBOO for keeping our station going. It plays a tremendously important role in the community. Please, if you're able, go to kboo.fm and donate. We need the support to keep the station on the air. As you'd expect, today's program is entirely devoted to the current extraordinary uprising. Not reporting on it, but putting everything in context, clarifying the underlying issues, and talking about where we should go from here. To lead off the program, Patricia Kohlberg and Jan Hocken take a look at myths around blackness, specifically how they're manifest in healthcare and affect the care that people receive. Desiree Hellegers beautifully reads a poem she wrote years ago, but only now published. In our recurring program Within the Old Mole, Another World is Possible, I'll explore the relationship between racism and the principles on which our society is organized, then bring on Candy Luisa Herrera to talk about police unions and the kinds of demands we make and should be making around them. Finally, Johanna Brenner and Bill Resnick discuss how to raise demands, how to work on reforms that actually have the potential for significant change. For music today, I thought long and hard about pieces from the Black freedom struggle over the years that have inspired me. I re-listened to Sweet Honey in the Rock, to Billie Holiday singing The Haunting Strange Fruit about Southern lynchings, and many others. I settled on Charles Mingus, the great bass and piano player. Mingus wrote Fables of Faubus. Orville Faubus, you may remember, was the governor of Arkansas who physically blocked himself, stood in the doorway of the schoolhouse to prevent integration. When Mingus went to record Fables of Faubus, his recording company told him he could not say the lyrics, he could only play the music. So Fables of Faubus is not what we'll hear. We're going to hear a live performance later on, and he called it Original Faubus Fables when he was able to say the lyrics. So this is live. I'm going to play just the beginning of it to start our program. It's a bit raucous being live, but stick with it. It's worth it. And we'll come back to it as the program proceeds.
Oh, Lord, don't let them shoot us. Oh, Lord, don't let them stab us. Oh, Lord, don't let them confeder us. Oh, Lord, no more swastikas.
Thank you.
That was the start of Original Phoebus Fables by Charles Mingus. Now, here's Patricia Kohlberg and Jan Hocken on healthcare and myths about black bodies.
Good morning. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I'm here today with Jan Hocken to talk about myths about black bodies and how they affect healthcare. I'm a retired primary care doctor and public health official. Jan retired from her appointment at PSU as a professor of psychology. She also worked for many years as a nurse and many more years as a clinical psychologist. The coronavirus pandemic has laid shockingly bare the disparities in health outcomes suffered by African Americans in the U.S. To put it simply, African Americans are sicker and they die younger. The main driving force behind these disparities is the social conditions that they are subject to, including racism. But the pandemic has also demonstrated the lack of access to quality care that Blacks endure. I, like many others, am hopeful that one consequence of the pandemic will be that this country finally adopts a universal system of health care access. But today, Jan and I want to step back a little bit to explore what happens when Black people actually do access healthcare services. How are they viewed by healthcare professionals, and how are they treated? Jan, what is your thinking and your experience about how and to what extent the racism of the broader society creeps into the healthcare system in this country?
Well, when I entered the field of healthcare as a nurse, both medical and psychiatric nursing in the 1970s, there was a very explicit hierarchy in place, particularly in the late 60s and early 70s, where the physicians were primarily white men, the registered nurses were primarily white women, the practical nurses, black women, the housekeepers, Latina women, and the maintenance staff were black men. And there were ways in which these groups and the grouping of workers within the institution translated into assumptions about the people receiving care. There are some around very explicit differences in the care people received. But there's been a movement, and I think this comes up around the policing issue too, toward attending to not just overt structural issues or overt racism, but what are the subtle ways in which even well-intended providers in a field such as healthcare can reproduce forms of inequality and oppression. And over the last 30 years or so, many colleagues in my own field, cognitive psychologists, have been looking more at what used to be called prejudice, unconscious prejudices, and now is more often called implicit bias. And it's an interesting area to take up as it relates to healthcare, because there's a literature looking at how providers, doctors, and other providers internalize dominant stereotypes and ideologies and enact those in various ways in their practices. There are some critical questions that have come up we might address in terms of how and why that happens. How responsible are people for their implicit biases? Or is it just, well, everybody has who grows up in a racist society is going to carry, particularly the dominant white group, is going to carry some amount of that. But I think there's been an interesting shift in the healthcare field to beginning to address this issue of unconscious or implicit biases in care.
Yeah, I had similar experiences as a physician coming in of age in the 80s and with those kinds of hierarchies within medicine and the kinds of segregations, actually, where people of color were often treated in different institutions from people who had more privilege, more wealth, who were whiter. And the implicit kinds of biases I think we were even becoming aware of at that time. But I want to go back historically first a little bit, because there are also some pretty explicit biases within medicine. And these have a long and interesting history that goes back centuries that include a bunch of myths about the bodies of African Americans and how they're different from whites. And these myths about Black bodies, for the most part, had absolutely no grounding in science, and they were often based on a fallacious understanding of the genetics of racial differences and not accepting or not understanding how race is a social construct. So these ideas about, these myths about Black bodies were largely formulated to justify and uphold the practices of enslavement and then later Jim Crow and other racist policies and practices. But the interesting thing is that a lot of these persist in medicine today. And I'm going to give just a few examples. The belief that I was taught and persists still in 2020 that observed differences between whites and blacks in hypertension and heart failure were due to genetics rather than the known physiological effects of stress from adverse social conditions, like racism, for example. Likewise, that blacks have poor lung and kidney function due to innate characteristics without taking any environmental factors into account. That blacks have thicker skulls and thicker blood and thicker skin, that they're more fertile. There's a very long list of these actually consciously held beliefs. And one of the most common and persistent myths is about black insensitivity to pain. And this was, of course, one of the underpinnings of the horrific treatment that blacks received during the slavery era. So there's been a lot of research on pain vis-a-vis the racial differences. Why don't you talk a little bit about why pain becomes such a fertile area for investigation?
Pain management is charged with a lot of moral judgments and has a wide subjective aspect to it. I think a lot of the research on the experience of pain focuses more on the subjective experiences of patients reporting pain. And interestingly, overall in the aggregate, African Americans are not underreporting pain. They do report often more pain, but are undertreated for it. So that one argument that prevailed for a period of time was, well, Black people are not treated as much for pain because they don't report it as much. But that actually is not the case. I think it illustrates also how many areas of medicine are not straightforward in the scientific way, but that they involve this complex interaction of interpreting distress that's often ambiguous. Pain is also charged with all kinds of notions of stoicism and expectations about what people should be able to bear. But for many years, clinical psychologists, you probably got this training too, over a decade ago, there was a lot of focus on the undertreatment of pain. And some of this early literature came out about which groups are undertreated. In recent years, there's this whole push to not prescribe so much. And so there are a lot of these shifts around concerns about addiction and who's more apt to be addicted. And actually, African Americans have a lower rate of, also contrary to myths carried by practitioners, they have a lower rate of becoming addicted to pain medication. But nonetheless, that association of people of color with addictions. Also, there can be a very punitive aspect to withholding pain medication, a kind of disciplinary aspect to it that I think is, it operates sometimes on a not so conscious level in terms of withholding medication from marginalized groups.
Yeah, I found also when I was reviewing the literature that African Americans were more fearful of becoming addicted to pain medications and were less likely to abuse medications, pain medications, and they have lower rates of drug-related deaths. But it's very clear that they are systematically undertreated compared to whites. And this has been shown in both chronic and acute pain. It's been shown in kids as well as adults. It's been shown in hospice care and in cancer care and in emergency rooms. And it's quite pervasive. And it goes along with some explicit feelings about African Americans that some medical providers endorse, that they're less likely to follow doctor's orders, that they're more likely to engage in risky behaviors, that they're more likely to abuse drugs, none of which has been proven in any kind of scientifically based study. So when we have this kind of systematic undertreatment, then there has to be, I mean, what we've discovered is that there are implicit biases behind this. So maybe talk a little bit about what an implicit bias is and how that might affect pain treatment, and then we can talk a little bit about what's to be done.
Well, there's a lot more literature documenting implicit bias than in meaningfully intervening in it. And psychologists and other social scientists are often much more equipped to document effect than to even untangle it. And there's something called the implicit association test that's widely used. And cognitive psychologists have been studying this phenomenon in police departments and healthcare and many sectors for decades. There are some problematic aspects to documenting these effects. On the positive side, the literature suggests that there is something very pervasive going on. And so with the policing or healthcare, it's not just the overt racist, someone committed to white supremacy, that's the problem. That there are these pervasive effects that we all share and carry to some degree, and we enact them or act them out or express them in various ways that we all need to take some responsibility for, as particularly as white people or a dominant group. On the other hand, this literature tends to be somewhat static, so it often doesn't make a distinction between people who do carry a belief because it's maybe something they pick up in movies or the dominant culture, but they're conflicted about it, or they realize they can't act on it, or they're not as invested in others in it. So I come out of a psychodynamic tradition that emphasizes more the conflictual dynamic aspects of these processes and also situational factors. There is quite a literature on, which is something we might look at in terms of the context that make people more or less comfortable with these false beliefs or oppressive beliefs.
Well, also, it's been well demonstrated that when people are hurried, when they're under stress, when they feel like there's a lot at stake, then their implicit biases tend to come more to the fore. And of course, that's sort of the usual working condition for healthcare providers.
Yeah, yeah, it's both relying on stereotypes as shortcuts to get the work done. But I think also these are very distancing kinds of oppressive beliefs that maintain a kind of otherness and reduce the complexity and the variability of the experiences of people. I think looking at the context and that fosters myths that are oppressive is really important. And there is less of that than there is these cottage industries making these tests and administering them to which are not completely worthless, because I think it does help for people to become more conscious of right. their implicit biases. But that as an end in itself, it can be a very shallow enterprise.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot more to talk about in regards to this particular issue, but I think we're out of time. So let's come back to this topic, maybe from a couple different angles, about implicit bias in medicine and how that affects and has very real consequences for African-American patients. So I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I've been talking today with Jan Hocken about myths about Black bodies as they are perceived in healthcare and what the consequences for that might be.
Thank you, Patricia and Jen. We'll have an opportunity to pursue some of these themes later in the program as we go more deeply into the relationship between racism and the economic and social underpinnings of our society. For now, a little meditation will do us good. Desiree Hellegers is a professor in the English department at Washington State University in Vancouver and founder of its Collective for Social and Environmental Justice. She recently published a poem called Koan. Koan is a relatively new word for an ancient concept. It's a prompt to meditation, often a paradox to contemplate, to take us beyond the realms of logic and rationality. Listen to how Desiree reads, to how she uses the line breaks to underscore the emotion. Also, early on, she expresses her skepticism. What is she skeptical of? Here's Desiree reading Koan.
Koan, in memory of Tikwanduk. For a week, we've studied the grain of the wood, seen how the floor grows. Golden in the afternoon light, we eat our meals in silence. See how white beans glow like moons on silver, and after words we dedicate the merit of these things we eat to help free all beings. But in the afternoon especially, I'm skeptical. I want to know what all this sitting has to do with war. Novices, we are learning to focus on a single breath. Our minds wander, and when the pain becomes too much, we move our legs, we shift. On the cushions, we learn that if you stay still long enough, you can see the mind spinning like a prayer wheel on its own axis. How time is a flickering picture moving backwards and forwards. Breathe in, you flash on Baghdad, Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, stress positions, the hooded figure atop the box, standing for hours, a human emotion detector. Breathe out. The soldiers are children at home, studying the only way they know to lose themselves, wired for hours. To the flickering box, they learn to move. The almost human figures make them fight, hold the controls, breathe in, and it is 1963, and Thich Quang Duc arrives with his retinue of monks, the can of gasoline and anointing, and then the match falls, the gasoline flares, the recorder reports. As he burned, he never moved a muscle, never uttered a sound. His outward composure in sharp contrast to the wailing of people around him. Here we are all novices. We are studying complicity, what to do with our eyes, how to let go of ideas, how to see without flinching. This much I know. We are worlds away from knowing how to respond to the sound of one body burning.
Desiree dedicated that poem, Koan, to the memory of Thich Quang Duc. When she writes about time as a flickering picture moving backwards and forwards, What is she saying about the relevance of these past horrors to our own times? What is the complicity she says we are studying? You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO FM. Normally, the part of the program we call Another World is Possible has its own theme music. Today, however, we're playing Charles Mingus' original Phoebus Fables. That was a bit more of Charles Mingus' original Phoebus Fables. Recent episodes of Another World is Possible have explored both an 18th century effort to create a utopian alternative to the prevailing society. We did that through a short story by Louisa May Alcott. And another episode, we began exploring the question of what it is that enables people to recognize alternatives. It doesn't happen always, nor widely. Now, all of a sudden, we're in a situation in our own time when people are seeing alternatives. We could talk about what enabled that sensibility, why issues kept alive by small groups have now become widespread. But it's important to recognize that not everyone in the streets sees issues the same way. So today, on Another World is Possible, we want to clarify large sets of understanding. For instance, the relationship between racism and capitalism, and the role of police unions. In a couple of minutes, I'll be joined by Candy Luisa Herrera, an organizer. Candy has extensive experience as a fierce negotiator for public sector union contracts. It's a realm of experience we need if we're to assess police unions. First, I want to suggest that racism is integral to the kind of social and economic arrangements that structure our society. In other words, the struggle to overcome racism is and needs to be part of the struggle to transform society fundamentally. For decades, social criticism, including main tendencies in Marxism, had seen capitalism as narrowly an economic system, equalizing and homogenizing workers, creating interchangeable workforce as the basis of future solidarity. This is what would enable us to bring about something significantly better than capitalism. Now we have a better understanding that capitalism is more than just an economic system. We know that its political rule requires divisions in the workforce and within the population. Our history of failed uprisings throughout the history of this country shows those divisions. Racialized capitalism is a new understanding, a new way of thinking about capitalism. One example of that, just to take modern times, you know about the monitoring technologies that are coming into workplaces, or monitoring keystrokes when people are at home. Well, those technologies also map diversity. They predict a greater danger of worker organizing when there's less racial and ethnic diversity in the workforce. In other words, built into the technology is the sense that we need more divisions in order to manipulate. Race functions also as a shock absorber in capitalism's periodic downturns. Racially identifiable part of the population gets the easiest and the first layoffs, or imprisonment. Prison, along with the military, are ways to deal with this society's inability to provide jobs. imprisonment, as we know, layoffs also, are racially based and require racial divisions. Now, to help us figure out what to do about racialized capitalism, we're joined by Candy Luisa Herrera. Hi, Candy.
Hi, Norm.
Good morning. Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thanks for having me.
Candy, you were instrumental. You took some initiative in setting up a panel for Jobs with Justice on police unions. And of course, you participated in the panel. Who was your intended audience? What was your intention in being part of that panel?
The intended audience were rank and file union members. And it really informed the points I tried to make in terms of hopefully provoking a discussion about the role that unions can play in police reform. And then particularly addressing the question about whether or not police should even have unions.
And your audience, of course, was labor people, the intention being to take the discussion back into their unions as part of a broader labor movement discussion, right?
Yes.
Whereas today we've got a little bit different audience and still want to take up some of those same questions, like specifically police unions. How do you understand the problem around police unions?
Put it simply, I believe that cop unions are the single biggest barrier to reform when it comes to police reform. And so it calls into question whether or not they should be part of the overall movement. And then folks have different arguments for why they should or should not. I think it's very clearly divided amongst rank and file members in terms of, you know, where they fall on that line. Some folks believe that, you know, they should still have unions, but they should only be able to bargain things like compensation and benefits, vacation, that type of thing. And other folks believe that they shouldn't have unions altogether.
In the present situation, most police across the country, I think it's most at this point, isn't it? Most are in something that at least they call unions.
Yeah, that's the case. They call, they're associations, whatever, they're still unions, they still bargain.
The first of those positions you just identified, some rank and file thinking that there should be police unions, but limited to particular topics of bargaining. That essentially amounts to bargaining on the same kinds of issues that other public sector unions bargain on. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. There have been a number of cases across the country where collective bargaining rights have been altogether taken away from some public sector unions. Some public sector employees. Taking away their ability for something like just cause wouldn't be, or due process or anything like that wouldn't be so beyond the pale in terms of what's been normalized in this country.
Well, what are the things that police unions bargain on that go beyond what other public sector unions can?
Yeah, so it varies, but some of the things they bargain at the local level is about when they'd have to give a statement after having killed somebody, a condition for under which they're going to give that statement, the number of breaks that they get. They bargain restrictions on releasing footage. So, for instance, when there has been a murder of an unarmed Black person, you often see a photo of the victim. But, it's much, much later that you see a photo of the police officers that were involved, and then his or her name as well, typically his name. So those are kind of the things that they bargain around. And then some units have the ability to, they've bargained their ability to kind of get with other officers at the scene and kind of collaborate in terms of what the official testimony is going to be about the incident.
You made the point in the panel that these kinds of provisions in police union contracts reduce accountability on the part of police when they use deadly force. And you related that to the empirical point that when police have organized unions, the rate of killings of civilians and specifically of racial minority civilians has actually gone up.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There's a researcher, he's actually an economist, but his name's Rob Gilzoe at the University of Victoria. And he studied bargaining rights of police beginning from the 1950s, from the late 1950s up until now. And so he found that obviously, you know, one of the things is they made money. You always do when you have a union. But that exactly like you say, it was overwhelmingly the case, he says, that there was an increase in the killings of civilians following the formation of police unions. And then that increase was almost exclusively non-whites.
And again, you understood that as being a product of these lessened accountabilities brought to police by the contracts that they bargained.
Absolutely. And Gilzoe phrases it very succinctly. He says it's protection of the ability to discriminate.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, what then actually is being bargained? I think you just answered that question.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, sometimes, like I said, it varies. There's many, many police unions, many, many locals across the United States. If you look in, for instance, in the collective bargaining agreement for Portland police, it very narrowly references deadly force incidents. And so it says to look in the Police Bureau Manual of Rules and Procedures. And that's actually where you find the more egregious regulations in terms of what happens after as they call it, a deadly force incident. So it's actually not collectively bargained to the best of my knowledge. Now, I bargain public sector contracts, but admittedly, I've never bargained a cop union contract. But it looks as if, like I said, the stuff that most people get angry with are actually rules that were created by the city, not by the union.
That's very interesting. So that's a suggestion that somehow the police, with their lesser accountability, once they've formed a union, it's not simply carrying out their own agenda, their own kind of racism, but that the agenda goes much deeper than the police themselves.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, management is absolutely complicit in a lot of these incidents where we don't see accountability. And so, you know, we could kind of go back and forth about this. It's kind of, it's a little bit of shop talk, but there's a number of things that can't be bargained that are considered management rights in the union world. And those are typically things like hiring and firing. That's clearly a management right. But another thing is discipline. And so, you know, they could create, if management wanted to, right, they could discipline people. You know, they could create discipline rules, a discipline matrix, it's often referred to, that is far more stringent and far more accountable to the community than they choose to have now. And so not to get too deep into it, but there's a number of things that management could do to create more transparency. Another one is just simply having open bargaining. And so that's when, you know, it's not behind a closed door. It's not two small teams working together. It's, you know, you even invite cameras in. You know, the state that I'm coming from, Florida, you could literally turn on public, you could literally turn on public access television and watch teacher bargaining. Now, nobody actually did that because for the most part, it's boring. But, you know, the expectation was that in that state, for better or for worse, because we're talking about very conservative values, that if you're an institution that uses taxpayer dollars, then there's an expectation of transparency there. And that doesn't seem to exist in Portland, or really for the most part in this part of the country, in the Pacific Northwest.
That would be one aspect then of public oversight. Yeah, actually, we're on to talking about what kinds of demands to make as part of this ongoing uprising, the movement that we're seeing. And you're suggesting two different targets for demands. One of them, we've been talking a little bit about management and the state, therefore. And you might want to say something more about that, what expectations we should have of them. But then also, let's come back to the labor movement itself and what our expectations, what even our demands or what we hope to influence within the labor movement.
Yeah, so I'm far more comfortable speaking about the labor movement because I've been involved for so long, and that's kind of where, you know, it's kind of my wheelhouse. Part of the reason why I wanted to have that panel was to really encourage rank and file union members to not be scared in pushing towards police reform and pushing for the notion that, you know, these cop unions, they don't need to be part of our movement. The main reason why people don't want to do that is because of fear. And the reason why is because unions have been under attack so long. And we saw this recently with the PERS vote in Oregon, right? It is, I think, very fair to say that the unions in Oregon are extremely weak. The fact that that happened, extremely weak. But that should not stop our ability to take a public narrative about this and say that they are explicitly, maybe they should have unions, but they shouldn't be a part of us, you know, and do the things that we should be doing. I mean, I could imagine, you know, us pushing for instance, a bill that takes away the ability for cop unions to be able to bargain some of the things that we talked about, you know? And like I said, the reason why other public sector unions don't want to do that is because they're afraid that the Democrats are going to get in bed with the Republicans again and then make that apply to public sector unions writ large. And so the answer to that would be that the fear is legitimate, but ultimately you need to do what should have been done for the PERS vote, which is go on strike. I mean, that is unequivocally the case. If you want to strengthen your union, that's what you should do.
Now, implicit in what you're saying is that the labor movement stands for something other than what the police unions evidence. I'm hearing that what the demand really amounts to is this is an opportunity to revitalize labor, have it come back to some of the underlying principles that we hope exist within the labor movement.
Absolutely. I mean, I certainly hope that's the case, right? I mean, that's why I got involved with unions. You know, and we've been on the wrong side of political issues for so long. I mean, it took until I think it was 2010 for the AFL-CIO to finally support comprehensive immigration reform because of some of the reactionary elements, you know, within the working class when it comes to immigrants and undocumented immigration. We dropped the ball in terms of having some vision about the future and understanding that, you know, jobs are moving overseas. I mean, obviously, we could have done far more to fight that, but you know, seeing what was on the horizon in terms of the tourism industry and getting in there and organizing that sector. You know, we've dropped the ball so many times and it's painful. It's borderline painful to see us as a movement drop the ball again on this.
Thinking of this as an opportunity seems to me to be a wonderful way to participate in the ongoing activities. I want to ask you just to clarify one last thing. And that's to other public sector unions. Some of our audience are going to be members of other public sector audiences. You are closely tied to one. What do you say to them directly when they raise the fear that you mentioned a minute ago, that an attack on police unions is just opening the wedge for an attack on public sector unions?
I would tell them that I completely understand the fear, and it's not entirely unfounded. That said, I am tired of living in fear. And frankly, it's no way to live. And so, you know, we have two options in front of us. We can either do nothing and maintain the status quo, or we could do something, take a risk, and ultimately be at a place where we're proud to be. We feel a newfound pride in being union members.
Back to that same point, this is an opportunity for the labor movement as a whole and for other public sector unions. Instead of cowering, this is a time to fight back. Very good, against any kinds of attacks on public sector. Candy, this has been terrific. I'm sorry our time is so short. We have lots more we could say about going about revitalizing the labor movement, or even about what alternative community safety could look like if we do cut back on some of the kind of policing we face now. Thank you. Thank you for joining us on Another World is Possible as part of the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thanks so much, Norm.
With Candy Luisa Herrera, we talked about the kinds of demands that make sense in the current uprising. Here are Johanna Brenner and Bill Resnick to go more deeply into how to work with demands so that they're simply not co-opted.
Hi, folks. Bill Resnick here with Johanna Brenner doing a commentary for the Old Mole in this time of multiple crises. And it's not just us as social justice and democratic folks who recognize this. Popular majorities think that we need great change, and great movements are rising with demands for change in our energy system and production and government and our ways of life and the police. We will win some reforms, maybe stimulus monies and renewable energy, some defunding of police and replacement with helping programs, higher minimum wage for essential workers, maybe even some form of public-private universal medical care. But most of the reforms will be concessions that those who run the system can live with, concessions that may even enhance the power of big corporations. Still, we have to work in those reform movements. It's where so many people are organizing to win some practical things and doing it motivated by hopes for more and for social justice, building out some forms of renewable energy, raising wages, keeping the police out of schools, reducing police murders, and destroying homeless encampments. Those are good things. But however good, we don't have to settle for those kinds of reforms, because we could, in the struggles, win the hearts and minds. We could discuss programs and real operating institutions that are not just reforms, but work and create life ways that empower people, that activate them, that build community involvement, that contribute to ordinary people participating in the decisions that shape their lives. Reforms that radically democratize, create hunger for more. And even if we don't win them in great numbers and size, we can get movements from movement activists and popular audiences, get commitments from them, and familiarize the society with those possibilities. So this radio piece will go into some of those reforms, partial to be sure, to demonstrate how in fighting for them and winning some, in doing that we can help people envision and get committed to that better necessary, radically democratic and sustainable world. So Johanna today are going to discuss first the health system. We'll also discuss jobs and material production and how defending and replacing police can create highly participatory and democratic programs that empower all the people. First, the health system. Johanna Brenner commenting on it.
Hi, Bill. So, Sonali Kostikar, a commentator on Pacifica radio show Rising Up, pointed out that, to quote, just as progressives were right more than a decade ago that a single-payer or Medicare-for-all system was the best poised to meet our health care needs, that same rallying cry for such a universal and free health care plan remains more relevant and appropriate than ever. Even the New York Times agrees, admitting perhaps a little bit reluctantly, that a single-payer system in which one entity, usually the federal government, covers every citizen regardless of age or employment status could work. We can and should go much further than changing how we ensure health care. We can envision and work for changing how health care is delivered, moving from hierarchical to more democratic forms of prevention and treatment. There are already models out there for doing this. For example, public health could be promoted through grassroots organizations that are controlled by the communities they serve. Another example, chronic diseases consume the bulk of health spending. Some clinics and hospitals have radically changed the way they help people manage chronic problems. Clients are involved in their own care and helped by teams of providers where doctors, nurses, social workers, outreach workers, and others function together on the team on an equal basis. The doctor doesn't tell everybody what to do. These practices improve skills, communication, and morale among the staff and have superior outcomes for patients. This is a model that we should fight to expand. It is true that creating teams at work now is often tied to management goals of promoting speed up and saving money, but that is because management still calls all the shots and holds on to their power. Still, even under those constraints, workers are more productive because they appreciate the small amounts of greater responsibility, voice, control, and dignity that they gain. We should not resist changes toward greater involvement of healthcare workers and teams, even if management is somewhat promoting them. But instead, we could use this moment to push for more democratization and greater worker control over healthcare organizations. Back to you, Bill.
So Johanna and I just discussed how we can go beyond universal health care, which is necessary, but would continue our very top-down system that doesn't work very well. And we can fight for that better democratized system that produces much better lives for patients and healthcare workers. Here's another example on work and jobs for all at living wages. Take the Black Lives Matter platform on jobs and income. It provides a fine example of seeking economic justice, particularly jobs and economic development programs. So it calls for, and I quote, federal and state jobs programs that specifically target the most economically marginalized Black people and compensation for those involved in the care economy. Job programs must provide a living wage and encourage support for local workers, centers, unions, Black-owned businesses, which are accountable to the community. It also calls for, we quote, protections for domestic workers, farm workers, tipped workers, and other workers, many of whom are Black women and incarcerated people who have been exploited and remain unprotected. This includes the immediate passage, I'm continuing to quote from Black Lives Matter platform, this includes the immediate passage at the federal and state level of Domestic Worker Bill of Rights, extension of worker protection to incarcerated people. And further, the Black Lives Matter platform also goes beyond these reforms to call for, again, we're quoting, financial support of Black alternative institutions, including policy that subsidizes and offers low-interest, interest-free or federally guaranteed low-interest loans to promote the development of cooperatives, food, residential, and many others, land trusts, and culturally responsive health infrastructures that serve the collective needs of our communities. This demand for cooperative work and land trusts that provide alternatives to top-down management by ownership and management by the few, that is, democratically run alternatives, has also been raised by auto workers whose factories have been closed down and shuttered all over the Western world. The auto workers, indeed, the entire group and the union sought public takeover of the factories in Oshawa, Canada, factories being closed, then to sell it to its workers at reasonable value, low interest rates, that to create a worker-owned and managed enterprise, a productive company that would involve its engineers and other engineers and its production workers in design and production of green infrastructure, as well as clean, democratic energy technologies, including solar installations and wind turbines. This is not some utopian fantasy. Worker-owned and controlled production firms operate successfully all over the world. Indeed, are very important to the entire Spanish, Italian, German, Scandinavian economies, using the great capacities of workers cooperating together to produce what we really need. We can surely raise these possibilities here and at least win people's support for them. We've so far discussed two examples of working in reform movements for universal health care and living wage jobs for all. How to work in them and all our movements to demonstrate the virtues of cooperative production democratically run and thus make work much more fulfilling while creating the goods we need and the services we need and better health for all. Here's another example, police defunding and how replacement services could be democratically structured. Here's Johanna.
Thanks, Bill. The remarkable movement sparked by the murder of George Floyd, its size, its stamina, its morality, its demands for justice, has gained wide popular support. Very, very, very exciting to see. And many people agree that the police should not be responding to mental health emergencies, people in trouble from alcohol and drug addiction, and many other problems. And this is happening in many cities, actually. In Portland, the police will no longer be in the schools or on the map. And it appears that further changes could well be made by the city council and the new DA. But this raises a question, what kind of services will replace the police? Will they be mostly top-down and professionalized treatment, assisted by prescribing large amounts of pharmaceuticals? Or instead, will there be alternatives that are primarily people helping people programs? Like Street Roots here in Portland and Sisters of the Road Cafe, these are organizations that serve the houseless community and involve houseless people as participants and decision makers. They're not perfect, of course, and one reason why is that, like the communities they serve, they don't have the full resources they need to carry out their mission. They operate on a shoestring, and democracy takes money because you need resources to have the time and staff to help people develop their capacities for participation and decision making. But nonetheless, they are programs that are run by and for the communities they serve. The city has taken money from the police budget to fund a new program, Portland Street Response, which is meant to replace the police in dealing with problems with houseless people, people in mental health crisis, and so forth. Will this program replace one oppressive city force with another social service bureaucracy whose decision makers are far removed from the people the organization is supposed to serve? Or will this program be organized with a robust system of community participation and community oversight? Will houseless people be hired? Will the families of people in mental health crisis have a say in setting up and evaluating the program? Here is a moment where we can raise new and broader ideas about how to democratize social services in Portland, following the lead of Right to Survive and other grassroots groups in our community. Let's take advantage of this opportunity. Over to you, Bill.
Thanks, Joanna. So it's time to conclude. Hope we have shown that while today the reforms we can win will be far from enough to even approach solving our many deep institutional crises, they can be stepping stones. They can be fought for in ways that show what would be necessary, that we could create a health and medicine system that we all deserve, that served all our people so much better, and a productive system that offered good work for everybody such that all gained and used their capacities to make and grow the products we need. And we can build helping systems for all with severe troubles that enable them to work their way out of it and find better lives. And all our systems would gain from the vast creativity, the ingenuity, the compassion of ordinary humans of our extraordinary species. So stay tuned on cable and this Old Mole Show for more on working in reform movements. Thanks for listening, folks. This is Bill Resnick and
Joanna Brenner
coming to you from KBOO Radio and the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thanks to all our participants today, to Jan Hocken and Patricia Kohlberg, to Desiree Helligers, to Candy Luisa Herrera, to Bill Resnick and Joanna Brenner. This has been Norm Diamond for the Old Mole Variety Hour. The show will be posted later today. You'll be able to find it, re-listen. I hope you listen again to Desiree's poetry on the KBOO website. Look for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Tomorrow is Bastille Day, of course, July 14th, anniversary of the French Revolution. Celebrate it well. And also in Chapman Square tomorrow from 7 to 8, the Buddhist Peace Fellowship is going to have a public silent meditation in support of Black Lives Matter. Finally, we go out with Charles Mingus, the conclusion to his original Phoebus Fables. See you next week.
Nazi fascists approve! Boo Ku Klux Klan with your Jim Crow!